This week on the Barag World Show, we talk hiring people, selecting images, workshopping and lifelong learning. This week's show is sponsored by Proposify and Teacup Analytics. BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and joining me on this week's show is Ryan Taylor, Marcus Lillington, Sam Barnes and Andy Clark. Hello all.
Hello.
Good day. Good day.
Hey, good day. Go on. Yeah, I know you're desperate to tell people, Andy.
We've got our visas.
Yay.
So we are now legally, lawfully allowed to reside and work in Australia.
Good.
So that's very, that. Very
congratulations.
Here. Thank you. That was a very nerve-wracking few weeks. Not that there was any reason why we would have them turned down, but you never know, do you? And so we have about another week and then we'll be off down under.
So you're not going to be joining us for the next couple of shows, is that right?
No, I'm going to ask our good friend Dan Edwards to sit in my warm seat.
Ooh, that did sound wrong.
Not
you're
going to
miss my birthday. It's my birthday next week.
Oh, bugger.
On the Monday.
Well, it's actually the Tuesday, but we may as well go for Monday.
He just wants to sing happy birthday, don't he?
It's not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
No. I'll sing happy birthday to you, man.
Thank you, Ryan.
I'll record a little segment and then Paul can drop it into the podcast.
Yeah.
No, I won't do it.
No,
I'll be joining my...
You're too old to be celebrating your birthday, Marcus.
It's just a reminder
you're a year closer to death.
Well, that's every minute of every day, isn't it, Paul?
But I know, but at your age is particularly telling, isn't it?
No,
carry on.
Being 50 and in your 50s is way better than being in your 40s, because being in your 40s is kind of, you know, it's just kind of not neither here nor there. You know, you're not kind of... You haven't got that elegant sophistication, that kind of George Clooney-esque aura about you, which, of course, being in your 50s, you have. So I think that Marcus should embrace the 50-ness.
I absolutely will. No question on that. I'm quite looking forward to it. I find that in the last few years, maybe it's becoming a granddad as well, it seems like... Nothing is quite so important anymore, and that's really quite liberating.
Yeah.
It's cool.
But then, don't you find that generally about getting older?
Yeah.
That the older you get, it's like, I look at my poor teenage son, where everything is traumatic and, you know, dramatic in life, isn't it?
And he'll have such, you know, he'll have impossible expectations of himself and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, what is expected of me in the world, and I have to find my mark and all those kind of things. Oh, yes, that's tough.
I wouldn't go back to that. When you get to our point, you know, all of your dreams have been shattered and so there's nothing to worry about anymore.
Yeah. You've had the cry in the shed at the bottom of the garden.
Yeah.
Realizing that this is it.
Hang on, are we just joking now?
I don't know.
Like a therapy session.
Yeah, that sounded real.
That was very specific for Marcus there, wasn't it?
Just?
No, yeah. I read somewhere, I can't remember who it was that made that analogy.
It happened to a friend of mine. Yeah.
Oh, come on, you know me, Paul. That's the least likely thing I'm going to do.
Yeah, no, that is true. I'll give
Hang
you
on,
that.
Was it worse? Did you not cry, just stared?
Yes, staring at the floor for an hour.
I think that being 50... It gives you actually more opportunity to be rebellious. I'm feeling more rebellious now in my 50s than I did when I was like 22.
It's watching my daughter and her new husband with their baby. It reminds me of how much of a more serious person I was when I was her age. And, you know, doing the right thing. And I'm just an idiot these days. I'm just, it's any excuse to party.
And which is great. It's, again, it's the advantage of getting older. Your inhibitions go as well. And it's just wonderful.
Yeah, you have all this to look forward to, Ryan and Sam. I don't know how old you are. You're younger than me, that's for sure.
Sam looks older than all of us, I think.
it's really, I just mentioned so much before we came on, but I'm like older now than I was when I first met Paul.
Yeah.
Like, the people I'm working with typically are all in the, like, early 20s. And I'm, like, more, you know, in some cases more than 10 years older than them. And it does feel very weird. It does feel very weird. And, you know, and I'm settled down. I've been married for 10 years. I've got 3 kids. And, you know, and I'm 33. I'm not that old. But you do feel different, you know, from that early 20s. And Dan's still in his 20s as well. This had been a good conversation to have when he's on, because he's like, he's just got a rabbit and his girlfriend, so he's got a completely
the first baby, that is.
Yeah, that's the trial baby. Can we keep this alive?
We had a cat, a dog, and then a baby. This is how we go. And then we had loads, we had another baby and loads more dogs.
How does that work then with Sam? Sam, you've got like 300 cats.
No. This, I've got one cat. All the cats that I post are, I volunteer for the RSPCA at the weekend.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. Because it's like, I dread weekends.
Do you know what? I enjoy it now. I enjoy it for 2 reasons. One, because I get to do the volunteering and post the pictures. And there's a little part of me that posts it and thinks there's going to be people like Paul out there who can't stand me now. Good.
Yeah.
Eat me. Go away.
It's just... 99% of the time, Sam, you're my favourite person on the planet. And then Saturday. Just once a week, you just turn into the devil incarnate.
I did think once about putting a hashtag on it so you could mute it. And then I thought, you know what? Screw you all. Screw you all. I got to look at your crap as well. Comes through.
I love that attitude. That's really good. I nearly once asked you to put a hashtag on it. So I'm glad I didn't.
Good.
Because you would have
felt the wrath.
Yeah. Hey, can I ask a serious question?
Yes.
Because I've got a serious question. And this is something I've been agonizing about. Going back to what we were talking about, was it just before we started the show, we were talking about books and keeping up with stuff. Do you guys have a set time when you spend learning and reading and that kind of stuff? And if so, how the hell do you make it happen? Because I've been so shit. It's taken me forever. I've been reading Jerry McGovern's book called Transform. And it's not a thick book. And it's taken me months to read it because it always seems to get pushed out. And I just wondered whether anybody had like an answer to this, because it's been driving me nuts.
Well, we were talking before, I kind of do what Ryan does. I listen to audiobooks more than sit down and read, just purely because I can do it while I'm doing things. It's the only way I've been able to keep learning, really. It's the only way.
It's my bugbear, Paul. I say that because I love reading, but I only really love reading fiction, and I really struggle to keep up. This show has been... It's been a godsend for me, because I just kind of, things get discussed on here that seep into my brain and stay there, and it keeps me relatively up to date. But no, I haven't got books and books and books, but I've got quite a few that, you know, I've read the first chapter of.
And it's like Instapaper, isn't it? Instapaper is, and Pocket and things like that. They're this kind of constant sense of guilt to me that I've got all these great articles in it. I never read them.
I've still got some articles in there, I think, from when I was putting together a talk in 2013. And I have still haven't read them, and I haven't cleared them out. So, yeah, it is guilt. Now, it's just constant guilt.
We do suffer from information overload, though, don't we?
Yeah, there's so much stuff out there. We can't possibly be expected to keep up with everything. No way.
But I don't remember having this trouble sort of 5-10 years ago. I kind of felt like, was there just less out there in our industry? Because I kind of felt like you wouldn't have to go, you don't have to go to a few places and you could sort of pick up on the latest stuff. But now it's just, which area do you want to specialise in? And then you're still struggling. That's how I find
it. But this is what I struggle with, is that, you know, I'm paid as a consultant. You know, it's all right for Ryan and for Andy, you know, because... no, that's not so right. It's different, isn't it? That you know, you've got a very specific, well-defined area.
It's not so much anymore, though, because the lines are blurred. Like when I remember, for a few years, all I worried about was HTML and CSS.
Yeah.
And now the number of different frameworks, managing conventions, you know, tools, third-party services, APIs that are running through my brain. I mean, it gets to the point where you think, if I have to learn one more frigging API, you know, or, you know, I'll interface with this, I'll figure out how to, you know what I mean? It's just overwhelming. It's just, exponential. I remember though, Paul, when there was just like Boag World and maybe a couple of other podcasts. And now, if you want to listen to stuff about web design and web development and UX and everything else, there's 50 million.
No, there's only this one to listen to. Never mind the others.
But Paul, you mentioned about being the consultant there. Like, I've done a few of those myself, a few sessions, and I think I know what you mean. So when I'm going in somewhere as a consultant rather than, I guess you could say, a specific job, I do get this sense that I'm expected to know everything. And actually, that's not, I think we both know that's probably not true, and yet I still feel it. I don't know about you, but I just try and get as much as I can about what they want to know before I go in, so I can actually research. And I've started to get used to comfortable saying that, and I've not had any sort of pushback yet, because I guess people don't expect everyone to know everything, right?
That's quite a good way. Do you know, that's so obvious, isn't it? But it's not something I've ever particularly thought about doing.
It helps me out. It makes me feel a little bit better. I can actually do some reading.
Well, I'll tell you what I've decided I'm going to do for now, and it feels fairly radical, but I'm going to try and set aside every Friday for just experimentation and learning and that kind of stuff, which is obviously a huge chunk of time. But I just feel, it's a certain degree of kind of imposter syndrome and paranoia, but I can't help but feel that if I don't really kind of double down on this and put some effort into it, I'm going to become obsolete, and that, you know, that I'm not going to be able to keep up.
Maybe it would be help if you sort of focused those days on, maybe like this Friday, I'm going to just dive into this area.
We only book out with clients 4 days a week, and we keep Fridays or at least one day a week where we're working on internal stuff and reading up on things that we need to read up on, because we've got little side projects that need attention, and you can't just leave them week after week after week when people are using them and feeding back and stuff like that. So you do need to have some time that you can dedicate to that, and fitting it in around at different points of your day is really disruptive. So just having a block of time where you can just say, right, I've got that to fix, I'm going to do that Friday, and jumping on it Friday, and, you know, I'm going to read about how to do this on Friday, you know, and just kind of try and schedule it. And it doesn't always work, and sometimes your Friday becomes a Tuesday because you need to jump on something urgently, and you work Friday on client stuff. But we try and loosely keep to that.
Well, I was wondering about this from, you know, with my new job and my new team that I'm going to have. It's how we kind of allow for this inside the working week. I mean, I've had employees in the past that it's been a bit hit and miss sometimes in terms of what you can learn and when. And often, you know, it's kind of down to the individual, isn't it? It's almost like, you know, doing the stuff in your spare time, which kind of isn't really fair. I think there should be kind of like actual work time set aside for it. So how do we schedule that? I mean, I don't know whether it's possible to do, you know, there's always the kind of, what was it, Google kind of 80-20 rule, or, I think Clear Left do something, don't they, where they set a certain amount of time on kind of like non-client related projects or something. But how do we kind of move that into the learning part?
One thing that, you know, I do think you can take advantage of is, again, something we were talking about before the show started, which is downtime. You know, Ryan and Dan were talking about, or Dan isn't here, but Ryan with Dan, was talking about how sometimes there's more or less design work or development work or whatever else. So, I mean, that's where you take advantage of stuff, but you almost need people to have some kind of learning program that they're working through, or at least some kind of idea of what they're doing. Otherwise it just turns into faffing time. It was a bit like Sam said, really, with me.
I think one thing we do at Marks and Spencer is you have your 10 or 20% time, but one thing I want to bring in, I've had it at other places as well, is whatever you're working on, you have to sort of present on it. Doesn't have to be polished, doesn't have to be great. Yeah. It just is a regular cycle of a weekly thing where people talk about what they've been doing in that time, and it kind of creates a bit of a heartbeat to it, and also a purpose that you can't just go off and, I guess you can say, you know, faff around and do something that's not particularly useful to anybody. But do you know what? Sometimes you can do something for yourself, but if you're sharing it, you never know who you're going to get interested or get some feedback, that kind of thing. So you can create a routine around the learning rather than schedule the learning time itself. And people can kind of do it whenever they can. And that kind of works.
Yeah, it's interesting. I tell you one little thing that I'm going to do, which is cheating. is I'm going to take a Marcus approach and use next season of the podcast as an opportunity to be introduced to some new stuff. So actually, if you're listening to this, you might want to pay attention at this point. Not that you haven't been so far, obviously.
Look up now.
Yeah, look up now. Pay attention. So what I'm going to do for season 18, I was thinking, is instead of doing another roundtable, although I love the roundtables and we'll definitely come back to this format, is do a season of lightning talks. Ooh. Right? Well, I've been thinking, right, partly because of you, Sam, and what you were saying about being an introvert, mm-hmm. and not liking speaking and that kind of stuff, that there are a lot of people out there which have got some really great ideas, but the idea of standing up in a conference or even a meetup is horrendously terrifying. Mm-hmm. And what's a nice, easy way of kind of getting into that mindset of speaking and sharing without kind of having the horror of suddenly finding yourself on a stage faced with all those people?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking we'll do a whole section of pre-recorded, so you can go away in your own time for 10, 15 minutes, talk on a subject, right? And you can give a talk, and we'll include that talk on the show. Me and Marcus will talk around it, or anybody else.
Can we judge them harshly?
I'm not sure you're entirely getting the spirit.
Oh, sorry,
of this,
yes,
Marcus.
No. Yeah, that was a 4 out of 10.
Yeah, yes. I thought that the content was great, but the delivery sucked.
Oh, dear. That's really encouraging, isn't it?
Yeah. No, we won't be doing that. No. So what I'm thinking is, basically, I mean, if we do lightning talks of 10 to 15 minutes, I reckon we can do over 40 in a season, right? Mm-hmm. So I think in the end, I'm going to be begging people to do this, because that's a lot of people's time and effort to go to. But
we'll have to do at least one each of our own, Paul.
Yeah, we'll all do one as well. Absolutely, you know, and I'll be, you know, pushing other people to do that, and maybe even more than one, you know. So you can submit as many as you want, and that's absolutely fine. And it, you know, I'd love people that have never spoken before to do it, but I'm kind of open to anyone, really, you know, even somebody that's a kind of long term speaker. I just want a big variety of different content, partly to kind of ensure a good variety on the show, and also, you know, to expose us to lots of interesting things. So what I've done is I've prepared a whole blog post on exactly how this will work, and also on some advice about how to do it well. And even if for some reason, if, you know, by some freak, I end up with more than the number I can include on the show, which I very much doubt. But even if I do, I'm going to feature everybody's on my blog. So they'll all be available. Good, bad, indifferent. We're not going to make any judgments. And it's just a kind of chance to have a go at it, really, and see how you get on. So you can find out more about how it's going to work at boag.world/season18.
I can think of a certain managing director at Headscape that would be great for this.
Exactly.
He could speak on analytics.
I think that's a really good idea, Paul. I think I'd have loved that kind of thing to get into this speaking business. That would have been really good. Yep.
And also, the other thing that occurred to me when I was doing it is that there's a whole group of people that can't do speaking, even if they're really talented at it. You know, maybe people with people who are caregivers. That's always a big one. Mm-hmm. You know, because you're looking after a child or a relative or whatever else. You can't spend time going off to conferences, or if you're disabled, there are some situations where you can't easily attend conferences. So there are all kinds of reasons why people could be excluded from this. And I just wanted to kind of open it up and have a load. So yeah, that's the plan.
I like that.
Good. Good. I'm glad I've got Sam's seal of approval.
I'm really liking that.
You validated me as a human being.
Anytime.
Right. Let's quickly talk about a sponsor before we get into our discussions. Ooh, for today.
Who's our sponsor today, Paul?
Our sponsor today is Teacup Analytics, Andy. So Teacup Analytics was, I think they started on last week's show. And the reason I'm really excited about having them in the show, because they're a product that I absolutely love. I've been mentoring the guy that created it. And also it's a product I use and I've actually found helpful, which is always a good thing. So it's essentially a tool that allows you to create reports to send to your clients or to your manager or whatever else. So it takes all that kind of that valuable data in Google Analytics and turns it into something very clear and easy to understand. So it's all built around questions. So you have a question such as, where is my traffic coming from? Or which channel is best converting? That kind of thing. And there's a whole section. You just go through and pick whichever questions you want. And then it compiles a report for you that you can then pass to whoever. Because reporting to clients on the performance of their website is a huge challenge. And I think a lot of us generate reports manually each month, and they're kind of ugly and you have to hack them together and they don't really impress the clients very much. So Teacup Analytics saves your time for producing those in a few ways that I want to just quickly mention. One is that there's no need to custom build reports for each client. Teacup lets you select a library of ready built reports that cover every client question. So if a client turns around to you, you know, for one client wants to talk particularly about bounce rates and another one's got, you know, an interest in something else, that's easy. You can easily just select the appropriate questions, assemble them specifically personalized to the client, which is great. And then you could even set it up so that the reports are sent automatically to the client as well, which is a really useful thing to be able to do. So it automatically sends them out each week or each month. You can set it and forget it. And the best part, of course, is the reports are lovely and your clients are going to love them, and that makes them like you and you get more repeat work, and the whole world is this beautiful and wonderful place full of flowers and rainbows and unicorns. So that is Teacup Analytic. You can find out more about him at boag.world/teacup. So then, discussion time. Not that we haven't been discussing stuff already, but you know what I mean. Marcus, I thought I might start with you because you got missed out last week.
I did. But before...
So you didn't make a fuss about it like Andy did?
No, I was upfront about how much it wouldn't bother me at all.
Yeah, because you're mature.
No, I can't help being sensitive, you know? People think that I'm just this, I don't know what, but, you know, no, I'm a little delicate little flower I am. I'm like a little daffodil just poking its way above. I'm like a snowdrop.
I could write a list if you want, Andy, of things that people think about you. If you'd like me to.
Does Snowdrop feature on the list?
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't actually, does it?
No.
Unless that's a euphemism for something else, maybe. <I don't know.
laughs> Anyway, Marcus.
Yeah, but I was going to talk about you recognising uniqueness. But before that, I have to say that I'm the proud owner of a plethora of USB-C adapters now.
Oh, well, yes. Have you upgraded
so
then?
So my MacBook Pro will be arriving this week.
Ooh.
It's quite exciting.
So you've got all the adapters, but no MacBook
they,
to
they
plug
arrive
it
first, as things like that always do. Huge boxes.
That's so funny.
There's tiny little adapters in them. Well, there you go. So, yeah, I'm going to be testing out these machines that we all said were badly designed, but it's time for a new one, so I had to get one. Anyway, recognizing uniqueness. This came, I tend to talk about things that I've just experienced. And I was, as you know, I went out to Washington a few weeks back and I was doing mostly stakeholder interviews. And these guys were telling me that they were a unique firm. And I thought, well, everybody says that. And lots and lots of clients we've had over the years say that they're different and or unique or they're a bit quirky or whatever. And you think, okay, and then you end up doing a kind of quirky or unique, in inverted commas, design, which then gradually gets kind of pared back to what they actually wanted, which was a corporate design, or basically a version of their competitor's website, which is just a bit better than their competitors.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
You're so cynical, but... I love it.
Yeah, all right. I suppose it's
you'll cheer up next week because you'll be 50 and suddenly laid back about the world.
I'll be nearly 50. I think it's an internal view often is that there is this internal view that, yeah, we're a quirky bunch of guys, you know, kind of thing. But actually, the external view has to be corporate because we have this corporate message and we work for corporate people. And the reason why I'm talking about this today is that this client I was dealing with are genuinely unique. And what I realized that the key question to them is, do people buy your stuff, whatever that be, it might be a product or a service or whatever, because you're unique, not you just happen to be kind of like quirky guys? And if the answer is yes, then that's when I think you need to develop a style that reflects that uniqueness. And if the answer to that question isn't yes, then you're probably actually what's required is something that fits within whatever industry norm there is. But another part of these interviews was, I was, you know, you tend to ask people, you know, are there any other sites that you admire, either within your sector or not, that you think might be, you know, useful that might help us in the process of designing a better site for you guys. And what I kept finding was, because I'd have a screen up with a browser open, and they'd be saying, oh yeah, can you go and have a check out your Gibson Dunn site or whatever other law firm it was. And pretty much all of them said, oh, they've got a new site, I like the old one. And and it was this was happened with three or four different sites because they kept referring to the same ones. And they all said, oh, I don't like that. The old site was great. And what I realised is, it seems that law firms are basically having to get new sites because their old sites weren't responsive or whatever, and they're just getting whatever the latest trend is, and they aren't designing sites that reflect the character of the firm, which is just that's the end of my thought for the week. But it was just interesting to work with a firm, or will be working with a firm, that people do buy their services because they're different, which I thought was kind of interesting. End of.
This whole kind of thing of, you know, oh yeah, we're kind of fun, cool people internally, you know, and we've got real character and all the rest of it. And then as the minute you've got to talk to the outside world, this attitude of, well, we need to be corporate because those people over there in that other company, you know, that we want to hire us, they're all corporate and sensible.
Yeah,
I call bullshit on that. Because I've been thinking about this a lot. I had to do a presentation a little while back on digital transformation. And one of the, and it was a B2B company, right? And one of the things that came up was the fact, oh yeah, all the examples you've given are B2C, right? And we're B2B, you know, and we've got to do things differently. And we're different in some way because our customers are B2B customers. Which strikes me as rubbish, because B2B people who buy B2B services, right, are the same people that buy B2C services. And it applies in the situation you're describing as well, that you know, just because I'm selling something corporate and sensible, the people buying it are still human beings. They still go down the pub, but they still take their kids, you know, to the play park. They still, you know, they're still human.
It's an interesting point, isn't it? I mean, well, here's a question for you. Should the lawyers in this particular firm, who are a really cool bunch of guys, and I'm really looking forward to working with them, should they have suits and ties on in their bio pictures?
Oh, I would say it depends.
So therefore, yes is the answer. Tricky one, isn't it?
Wait, when you say should they, do you mean should they look like that? As in, should they look so serious? And,
well, you know, these guys are serious trial lawyers. Yeah. They deal with some very hefty cases.
Yeah, I would say it, sort of irrelevant of my opinion. I would, again, base it on their business and who they're targeting. Let's, you know, if they're targeting that's their client, then the client base, and yeah, I think they have to, but I wouldn't just do it by default, if that makes sense.
Well, it also depends on the concept of the design as well. No, it doesn't test it. I mean, if you are, you know, if you think of yourself as kind of being a bit kind of edgy or whatever, wearing a suit and tie doesn't need to necessarily mean that you're going to be conventional or professional or whatever. The photograph of all the people could be done in like a Reservoir Dogs kind of way, right? And they're all wearing suits and ties. Yeah. And that's the kind of angle that the whole design might be based around, you know. Mm. The whole design might just be based around, you know, black and white silhouette-y type graphic-y things, which is going to give them their edge without, you know, making a kind of a trite point about it.
Very wise, Andy. Interesting point that came up. And, yeah, representing that uniqueness is something that maybe I can talk about later once we've done the project. But it's more of a challenge because you can't kind of just go by the book, but equally it's a much more interesting thing to do. And the idea of black and white, that kind of starkness is something that's already come up. So, yeah, interesting.
Well, tell you what, I mean, it talks about sort of quirky and personality and all this kind of stuff. But one of my little kind of pet hates is when you see websites and you go to the about page, and it can be web designers, it can be, you know, normal people.
Oh, God,
and
yeah,
you go to the about us page and it's, you know, Andy's been designing since blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and in his spare time, he likes to knit pink hats and, you know, ride kittens. And it's like, who cares?
Quite right. Yes,
it all has to be relevant.
And the ones when you roll over and they pull a funny face. That's one of my favourite things.
I get the laughing, but have you had any clients that actually enjoy that? Because I've been part of agencies where when we've won work or had whatever relationship with a client, several clients have commented on how they enjoyed that, and that's because in their line of work they had no possibility of having what they perceived as fun. They actually quite enjoyed that about us. Rather than, so it's interesting how we look at it and might think it's cheesy, but I think a lot of people who aren't in our world actually they actually read that stuff and they enjoy reading about knitting, whatever we
like,
do.
It kind of comes down to bright socks.
It comes down to what's the priority of your highest priority user. And if that sort of thing would piss them off, then don't do it.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's basically what it comes down to. But, yeah, representing character is hard, and that's going to be an interesting, you know, without making it cheesy or soft or not right. You know, you might be representing character in a way that you think's right but actually isn't. So it's going to be a tricky one and a good challenge to have.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to add something to wrap it up, and then I couldn't think of anything. So,
yeah.
So we'll move on to now. Andy.
Yeah,
we'll stop. That's end of that. Andy, speak.
My book of the day, of the week, was actually brought to my attention by our old friend, Mr. Andy Budd, who I shared a conference stage with him a year or so ago, and he was doing a workshop, and he was doing this a game storming workshop.
Oh yeah.
And one of the things that he recommended, and I tell you what, this was the story. I decided, because I had like a spare day after the conference, I had nothing better to do, so I was going to sit in on Andy's workshop.
You really sold it there.
Yeah, no, actually, it was really good. I did actually want to go, and I did actually asked him whether it would be okay for me to sit in, because, you know, not everybody wants somebody sitting like me sitting in on a workshop. And I found it incredibly challenging. It was one of those workshops where he would, speak for kind of half an hour about a certain topic, and then we'd break off into groups and do group activities. And I, to be honest, haven't done that. I facilitated a lot of those things, but I've never actually participated in them. And I found it really bloody difficult. It took me until well into the afternoon to feel comfortable about, you know, sharing ideas and stuff. Anyway, one of the books that he talked about was this book, Game Storming. It's a playbook for innovators, rule breakers, and change makers by Dave Gray and a bunch of other people. And I absolutely love this book. And in it, they talk about a lot of the kind of game scenarios that Andy talked about in his workshop. For example, if we're wanting to get clients to begin to open up about what their issues are and about what their objectives are, for example, from a design, what they think are the most important properties or features or benefits, etc., of a product, then rather than just, you know, asking them to fill in a spreadsheet, actually do an activity for an hour, 45 minutes, like, for example, designing the cover of a magazine. So, you know, if your product was going to be on the front cover of Time magazine, what would the strapline be? What would be the big headlines and the little kind of pull quote? Who would you have describing your product and its virtues on the cover of, you know, Time magazine, for example? So that was one of the story, one of the games. And then the other one was about a context map. And I think we also did something like, oh, yeah, designing the box. So if your product, no matter what it is, or service, came in a box, a cardboard box, what would be on the box? You know, how would you prioritize the, you know, the list of features and benefits? What would be in the big kind of star sticker that goes in the corner? All that kind of thing. And it really kind of helps clients to open up. And we've done this a few times now with clients, and it's actually really valuable. So I don't know whether anybody else has kind of done this process with clients, but it was new for us, and a lot of it came out of this book. So that's my pick for the week.
We've been doing these kinds of exercises for years. They're kind of staple of how we worked at Headscape, and I continue to do so now, and I'm sure Headscape still does as well. Yep. And it's incredibly useful, especially with design. You know, things like you talked about the box exercise. We always do a book cover, right? Which is the same kind of thing, basically. And the reason that it's so good is because you can safely involve the client in the design process without them micromanaging the design. So, you know, when they're designing a book cover, for example, they're designing what goes on the front, on the spine, on the back. And so effectively, they're establishing a visual hierarchy. You know, they're establishing key messages. They're making comment on color and typography and those kinds of things. But they're not designing the website. So it still leaves you in control as the designer, but they feel like they've contributed to the design. And so they've got a sense of ownership over it. So they're more likely to approve it. They're more likely to support it, etc. So absolutely, these exercises are great. They're also, they make these workshops and meetings more enjoyable. And they're also, some of the exercises are very democratizing as well. So in other words, you don't just get a few loudmouths dominating the meeting, but everybody gets to feed in, everybody gets to contribute. And Game Storming is just a really good book, as you say. The only thing I would say is I actually think the name is a little bit damaging to it in some ways, because it makes you think that you're playing games in meetings, and actually the ideas that they put forward, you know, they're activities, they're not really games, and so it is more serious than perhaps it sounds. Also, check out their website. Have you checked out their website, Andy?
Yes, and there's lots of good stuff on there.
There's loads more than's in the book on the website, and there's a whole community of people that are making suggestions and adding stuff as well. So some really good stuff. It's brilliant.
Cool.
Yeah, sorry, I got a bit overexcited about that one.
So brilliant. It's amazing.
It's amazing.
I actually picked something that you like, Paul. That thing that's got to be a first.
Yeah, well, it's not all that wishy-washy. Oh, look, here's some designer in the past who did something nice. We should all look at it, you know. We've had weeks of that, haven't we? Talking of practical suggestions, I'm going to do one. Won't take long, this one. One of the big challenges that I think a lot of clients have is imagery, right? So now we all know that we should be going out there and we should be getting, you know, proper good imagery done for our organization. We should have an image library where full of photography that's been specifically taken for our projects. And our products and what we do. But that often doesn't happen. And I'm not going to get into an argument about how important that is and how it should be done. But let's just spend a moment just looking at kind of the reality and some of the stuff you can do, especially around blogging and social media updates and that kind of thing. So those both blogs and social media updates evolve at constant production of imagery, and most clients aren't particularly savvy about stuff like that. Aren't particularly good at where they can find good quality imagery, all of those kinds of things. So I just wanted to recommend a couple of things that might help. Number one is a website called Pixabay. So Pixabay.com. And that is a repository of a huge amount of royalty-free, public licensed imagery. In other words, imagery you can use absolutely for free. Okay? And so go check that out, because that's got some really great imagery you can use as a starting point. Now, there is also a lot of rubbish in there as well. So in a minute, I want to just share a couple of tips about selecting half decent imagery. The other thing that I know a lot of people do is they have, shots of software or screenshots or that kind of stuff that they want to display. So there's a couple of websites you might want to check out for that kind of thing. One is browserframe.com, which is a really, really simple, really, everybody, all of you are going to find this. Whenever you do a mock-up and you want to show it in a browser, go to browserframe.com. You can just whack in your image there and it puts, you know, whatever browser around it you want, which is just so useful and quick to do. So that's a useful thing. Then there's something called smartmockups.com. Smart mockups will put your design or screenshot or whatever else on any device that you want. So you can show your screenshot in context. So that's another really useful tool you might want to check out. In terms of selecting imagery, there's a few tips that I think are worth giving when it comes to selecting imagery that doesn't look naff, right? First of all, don't feel you always have to be literal. One of the things that I see people do a lot when they select imagery is that, you know, they inevitably end up showing pictures of people shaking hands and that kind of stuff because they're trying to visualize the reality of whatever they're writing about. And in most cases, it's us sitting and having a meeting or, you know, those kinds of things. So you end up with really naff stuff. Try and think a bit more laterally. That's always a good one. Second one, always kind of look for slightly unusual angles that a photograph is shot in or cropped in an unusual way. That's always another way of making your images stand out. And then third is talk to a designer, right? Get a designer's input to establish some kind of style guide for the images that you're selecting. So instead of just, all of your images being different, a good designer should establish some kind of consistency across the imagery, in either in terms of, you know, how it's framed or, you know, what kind of thing appears in it or what filter is applied over it. And then the final piece of advice that I would give over this is make sure that your image has a strong central point of interest. So don't let it, you know, crowd scenes or things like that don't work particularly well on the web. No doubt Andy now wants to jump in because I suspect he's got a load of great advice on this as well.
No, I was just going to talk and say that the things that you were talking about there in terms of crop and angles and subject matter, that kind of thing, that's art direction. And that's something which, you know, you as a designer should be leading for the client rather than getting them to select images, because it's not just about showing. And I'm glad you mentioned people shaking hands. You forgot to mention the ethnically diverse. They've always got to be ethnically diverse people shaking hands. But that kind of thing is not really for the client to choose. It's part of your overall concept, I think, for the design. And that, you know, cropping things unusually is something that the art directors that I mentioned in my previous books that you so widely derided are all about. So that's all the point I wanted to make, really. The other thing I just wanted to quickly jump in and say, obviously for your ethnically diverse people shaking hands, there is actually a really, really good I think anyway, a good alternative stock library, which is called Colourstock. I don't know whether you've seen this. The URL getcolourstock.com. And basically, it's a curated photo stock library, but it only features people of colour.
Right, and, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah, and I just think that that's something that, you know, people might be interested in having a look at.
I mean, I totally agree. You, with the art direction thing, I think you're entirely right. It's just there's what should be and then there's the reality, isn't there? You know, absolutely, you want a designer to be selecting and working on your imagery, but it doesn't always happen, is the truth, especially on things like social media. Oh, which reminds me of one other site that you might, another tool that you might find useful, which is something called Spark by Adobe, spark.adobe.com, which helps you create, you know, nice, well, nice is a strong word, but a reasonable, acceptable social media imagery to upload, you know, with writing over it or whatever. Absolutely. Andy is 100% right that, you know, you want someone proper to do these kinds of things, to advise you and to set those kinds of styles. But if all else fails, just bear those things in mind. Okay, Sam.
Yes.
What have you got for us?
So I just wanted to give a couple of interview tips. So for people that that do interviews with candidates. I saw a tweet last week from a sort of ex-colleague, now friend, called Steve Bennett, who works at a company called Alfresco. And it kind of got me thinking about this topic. I've spoken about it before, and the tweet was, there are truly great places to work, therefore you should aim for a place that gives you the freedom to make it great, which I thought was very wise and very true. It just reminded me of something I've spoken about before, which is what I believe are mistakes many, many companies are making when they're hiring people in the interview part. All right, so there's two mistakes that I think people, employers, are making in our industry these days, and that is essentially bullshitting candidates and hiring rock star douchebags. So I just want to kind of go through rock star douchebags. It's a, you know what they are.
It's a technical phrase. Yeah,
you've definitely met some, Marks, I'm sure of it.
You implied that I'm one.
Carry on, Sam. Okay. So I just thought I'd go through really couple of, it's really like one tip, but a kind of a mindset of what I've used to sort of get around these two, or hopefully minimize these two things. And it's all based around being honest in an interview. So I'll just go through it quickly. So basically when I kind of get the person settled in the room, and kind of one of the first questions I'm going to ask them, is to tell me what it is about places they work, be it the present one they're at or any at all, that they both, what they think is good and bad about working at any company. And I don't restrict it to the sort of our area in terms of like technology or design. It's like anything. It can be that. It can be that. It can be the bosses. It can be the culture. It can be the coffee machine, for all I care. All I want to know is what are those things that essentially they really love about working at a company, and also the things that are really great on them. Right. And ultimately, they're the kind of things that build up and end up making people leave, which is kind of fine. That's not that strange, you're thinking. But what I kind of tend to do then is I'm then going to tell them my answers for my company that I'm at the moment, including the bad stuff. And I think that's what's quite surprising to people. So what I found over the years is that as I was sitting in interviews, saying less, I guess you could say less of a senior role, whatever, just to sort of listening more than contributing, I noticed that there seemed to be this trend across companies and across the years of selling your company to candidates, you know, and telling them all the good stuff, how wonderful it is, and all the stuff why they should join, and very little about what the reality is. And as we all know, pretty much every company I've ever worked for has issues, right? Everyone has issues, different ones. So I essentially tell them what it's like to work at my company. And it's kind of, it's interesting to see reactions, because what I find is that you can very quickly get a measure of someone's character when you start talking about the bad things. And what I've noticed over the years is a definite split. If I had to sort of categorize it, there would be a split between people that kind of look refreshingly surprised. They kind of really find the fact that I'm being honest quite refreshing. And the people that tend to have a different attitude, I guess you could say, when I start talking about bad things, they'll turn their nose up. They'll start, you know, you can very much tell that they're not liking the fact there are bad stuff at this company. And so essentially it's kind of like a tactic to get people onto my team who really value that honesty over the perks, I guess you could say, that we're typically used to sort of selling or seeing in our industry. And they're also, these people are wise enough to know that all companies have issues. So how this plays out in reality is that essentially the people that join, basically whenever I'm telling people what's not so great at the company, I'm always surprised when people accept because it's kind of a weird feeling. You're telling people, look, this is the reality, and I'm telling you because, I think it's best you know. So when people then have like multiple offers on the table and pick yours, it always feels kind of weird. But what I found is using that technique, you just reduce any kind of disillusionment building up, because typically what happens when I've been in those situations where companies are sold to candidates rather than the reality is that they'll get into the company and no matter what they thought before, it could be weeks, it could be maybe 3 months, but they kind of, you see what it's really like and you get disillusioned. You think this isn't what I was sold. It's not a really good way to start a relationship. Whereas when I do it this way and I have like a one-to-one or just pass them in the kitchen, whatever it might be, I'll always make sure the first thing I say to them after, say, a month is, how does this stack up to, compared to what I sold you? And what I'm actually looking for, the perfect answer is a kind of non-plus, yeah, it's pretty much what you said. And that, to me, is actually the best thing possible, because I've had so many experiences in the past where people are starting to see, the reality versus what they were told in the interview. Mm. And the other thing is really about people's character, I guess you could say, and it's this thing where I see so many companies hiring based on the skills and not the character.
Have you got an example of a bad thing that you might tell somebody?
What I try and do is I will tell them things that kind of all companies have or things that we have. So one thing that I would mention in the past is, say, we've got a platform that has quite a lot of technical debt. Now, to the people that have been doing this for years, that's not probably too surprising. But you will see people's reaction to that, and it can vary from people that are sort of younger in their career and they really don't want to work on platforms that are riddled with technical debt. They want to work on Greenfield or the new stuff. So you can see that. Some will say it. Some you can detect it. There are other things. So let's say you work at a company that isn't as flexible with time. There's not remote working, or it's not as easy, or whatever it is. Yep. You can say that's something we don't have. And it's just something you can get out there, put on the table, and you can very much see people thinking, okay, this isn't going to work for me. And when that happens, it's not a kind of, you failed this interview. It's more of a, well, this is sort of a dodge bullet for both of us, isn't it? It's about finding that match. And I think one quote from the film Good Will Hunting that always, just I think it nails it so much about how I see finding a place to work, but also interviewing, is from the film, Good Will Hunting, and it's Robin Williams. And he said, you're not perfect, sport, and let me save you the suspense. This girl you've met, or job, she's not perfect either, but the question is whether or not you're perfect for each other. Hmm. And I just think that's a really good way to think about both interviewing and joining a new company. It's not going to be perfect, but it might be brilliant for you personally. Yeah, and it's a way of just changing the whole dynamic of the interview, really, to make sure that it's actually a mutual two-way pairing process with honesty. And I've told people things about where I'm working, and they've joined, and it bemuses me. In fact, I've told someone once, and I asked him that same question, how does it seem compared to what I sold you? And he actually said, you made it sound worse than it is, which was kind of a strange thing. It's like I'm sort of the ultimate, underselling over delivering tactic. But it's just really, the main message is just to not sell your company to candidates. Just tell them everything, because they're going to find out. And you're gonna very quickly not have people join your company who become disillusioned, because when they do and they're disillusioned, it really does only take one or two people to be disillusioned and start being a bit toxic, and you've got a real problem on your hands. So, yeah, why go through that pain? Why get three people through the door based on their technical skills? And yeah, sorry, go on.
No, go carry on.
Well, it was just the final thing was, just please don't hire people based on their technical skills alone. I've been in companies where the interview questions were purely based around the skill and nothing about them as people at all. And no doubt there's some people that are amazingly talented, like they're super good, but they bring with them other things. They're a whole person after all. And, you put them into a team and it could just not be right, and they can just destroy your team. And please, all I'm saying is please got to talk to find out who the person is. Don't just rely on their skills. You can be a nice person and a developer, and a really not a nice person and developer. As good as each other. So yeah, that's my little bit for this week.
Just brilliant. I think couldn't agree more. Really, really good. I'm sitting here smiling.
I mean,
doesn't happen often.
The truth is, I started doing this tactic when I took over a team, and the, a lot of people were leaving that team as I took them over. And I, you know, the feedback I was getting, essentially the trend was that the job wasn't what was sold to me. So I just, and it just, there were certain things at this company that I couldn't change. There's no way I could change them. So, and people, and they, some of them were strange. So I just, you know, I just figured, why not just tell them? And I have to admit, my boss for the first few was kind of, it felt uncomfortable, and it felt uncomfortable to say it. But over the years, it just seemed to build a really nice team, you know, people that actually valued personal morals and values over the tech, and actually found these teams helped each other a lot more than before. Before, we had sort of them and us, you know, between technologies, whereas actually getting people in that are, you know, maybe do not have people that are sort of, you know, on the world stage or cutting edge, but as a team, they were brilliant. And I think that's the whole point.
It's always been my job at Headscape to basically sit on interviews with developers, and I've got nothing from a technical point of view, so my role is purely to try and find out a bit more about the person, which is valuable. It's great. Brilliant.
Cool. All right. Well, I would say we'd move on to Ryan, but as Ryan said at the beginning of this show, I don't know what to talk about. So, so you're off the hook this week, Ryan. You've got until next week to come up with something.
Fair enough.
Is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine.
You know, I don't want to offend you. I know that people get offended over this, or people as in one person.
I've got to open the show next week.
Okay, fine. No. Fine by me.
You're going to regret
it.
Yeah,
and I won't be on. I won't be on, so you can get my name wrong.
Yeah. Well, we won't mention you. There'd be no need to mention you, will there? Because you'll be dead to us.
Oh, yeah, I suppose so.
I think it's dead. I think it's a bit weird that my business partner's on the show next week, and I had no idea.
Yep. Well, that's, that about sums up working with someone else, really, isn't it? Okay, let's talk about our final sponsor of the day, Proposify. Is a proposal creating piece of software that I used for years. Really, really good piece of software. It increases your efficiency in all kinds of ways when it comes to producing proposals. But one of them is that it can sync with your CRM, your invoicing system, your project management tools, which is so useful. It integrates with some of the top business apps, so you can import contacts, you can link deals, you can generate invoices and create projects and all that kind of stuff. So, for example, it will link with your CRM for proposals, as you know, so you can sync the sales activities and deals and opportunities in your CRM to Proposify, which is really useful. So things like PipeDrive, HubSpot, is that Zoho? I think that's right. I know that they're a well-known brand. I've just never said them out loud. PipeDrive is the one that I use all the time, and the fact that it links to Proposify is just so incredibly useful, because you can link the proposals you're writing with the deals and the people you've got in your CRM. It's a kind of no-brainer, isn't it, really? Next one is you can manage your cash flow through your invoicing. So you can generate invoices and projects with one proposal. So you win a proposal, it automatically creates a project or an invoice in apps like Infusionsoft, I should know that, and FreshBooks. And then the final one is that you can use it to project manage your proposal process. So you can import proposal details, contacts, and generate projects on one deal. So you can invite team members and clients to be involved in a project with apps like Basecamp, Harvest, that kind of thing. So it integrates closely with all of these different platforms, which makes everything so much easier to manage. Right. Okay, so that is Proposify. You can find out more about them at proposify.biz/BoagWorld. Now, Marcus, do you have a joke for us to wrap up with?
I do. Am I sounding all right?
No, you sound, for me, you're sounding echoey, but let's not. Yeah, I'm thinking you'll be all right for the actual recording, Marcus, because you're recording locally, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. Very quick joke then. I think Ian at Headscape came up with this one. Did you know you can't use beef stew as a password? Because it isn't strong enough.
Oh, that is terrible.
Oh, I like that one.
It's good, isn't it?
That is a good
one. That is. I like that a lot in a kind of it's terrible way. Oh, brilliant. Good one, Ian. Who knew he had such a sense of humour? Well, he must do to work with you guys. Aha! See what I did there? Okay, so best place to find out about each person. Marcus, why don't we start with you?
Headscape.co.uk and very, very occasional tweets at Marcus67.
Sam?
Website is thesambarns.com and Twitter is @thesambarns.
Ryan?
We're nodividestudio.com and on Twitter I'm @RyanHavoc.
We're going to get that twice next week, aren't we? No Divide Studio. That's going to be annoying. You'll get double the mentions. And Andy?
You can get me @stuffandnonsense.co.uk and @malarkey on Twitter. And I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, when you'll be in Australia.
We will.
How cool is that?
I know.
Good luck, Andy.
Thanks, mate.
And finally, just to say, don't forget to submit your talk for next season. We're really excited about doing this, so you can find out more about that at boag.world/season18. Thank you so much for listening, and talk to you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Oh, my God.